the morning.
Mr. Tate has a fairly long history now. I'm sure the court is familiar with it. He's up here once before on an appeal from the decision of the First District Court of Appeal in O'Neill 1, which created this rule of law that's discussed in Proposition 101. At that time, the court declined to hear the question. I think it was not quite right at that point in time for review by this court, but we're now back in court pursuant to the conviction of Mr. O'Neill and the subsequent imposition of death penalty. And I think the issue is now squarely before this court and ready for review for decision. I think the real problem that as appellate counsel I have with the decision in O'Neill 1 is the creation of a new rule of law, a new definition for criminal trespass by lower court. And the attempt that the trial court then has to make to try to apply that rule, to apply that definition in the trial setting with no guidance. And I think the result in this case is a clear indication of the problems that that rule of law created. The First District was very upfront about that in O'Neill 2. And said basically, we have created a new rule of law here, the O'Neill rule. And we've created a new definition of trespass that did not exist before. And this is what it is, and this is how it's going to apply. When the case came to trial, the Winklers were left with, how do I instruct the jury? Because the traditional definition of trespass and aggravated burglary doesn't mention the O'Neill rule. And he crafted a jury instruction the best it could based on what the court said. But that instruction in itself reflects a misunderstanding on his part, not only of the state of the law after O'Neill 1, but even the basis for the decision in O'Neill 1. Because it combines both the O'Neill 1 basis for finding a trespass with another basis that the First District essentially rejected, that idea that the force used in effecting the entry into the wife's residence is what creates the trespass, rather than the decision to establish mutual or different residence, the mutual decision to live separate apartments.
Counsel, in State v. Lilly, which is a case I know you're familiar with that we recently heard, the argument was made that the section of the code in Title 31 has no application and does not grant any sort of really not a privilege to enter. It's more of a privilege with regard to property rights, and therefore doesn't have an application in the criminal context. What do you say about that?
Well, Your Honor, it's axiomatic that a criminal statute, the criminal code, if you're going to criminalize conduct, you have to define the conduct in such a fashion that the average citizen is going to be able to understand. The average citizen reading that 3109 statute is not going to understand that it applies in some circumstances and not in others. The statute, plain language of the statute,
Her
spouse may not be excluded from the residence of the spouse. It doesn't say he may not be excluded only in civil cases, or he may not be excluded as long as he doesn't intend to commit a criminal offense there.
Okay.
He may not be excluded.
That's an argument about the statute might be a vagueness. Is that you're making a vagueness argument there? Or?
I don't believe that the statute is vague. I believe the language of the statute is very clear and precise.
No matter what the circumstances are, one of the spouses leaves the marital home and rents an apartment, pays the rent, etc., your argument is the other spouse has access to the new residence of the spouse who left?
May not be excluded by law without a court order.
So during coverture, you can never have a separate residence unavailable to your spouse.
Well, that's the way the statute is written.
Well, but do you think they really meant that? you think the statute is written that, maybe as Justice Cook suggests to you, that it isn't applicable to this situation.
I don't believe that's the case, and there's been a long history of this statute being used to prevent burglary convictions when one spouse who breaks into the residence of another. If the legislature had not intended that, they had a long history of this statute being applied in this fashion, and it was clearly understood to prevent burglary convictions under those circumstances.
But again, then, it is your position that during coverture, there is never any way, even if you live 100 miles from your spouse, that the spouse is excluded from your, where you're staying?
Certainly, there's a very simple way, chain of order. And there are a number of procedures that have been instituted by the legislature in order to allow the spouse to obtain.
Look at the facts of this case. She just didn't have sufficient time to obtain the court order.
And that's correct. And there are, and if she had obtained the court order, would it have stopped what happened here? Probably not.
How do you get the court order? You're talking about a domestic violence court order?
Yes.
All right. What if you aren't afraid of domestic violence? Mm-hmm. What if you aren't afraid of domestic violence? That the husband is just wants to take the grandfather clock, so he decides to go in. He doesn't want to hurt anybody. That's okay.
If you want to do it civilly, there is a civil procedure for doing it through the Court of Domestic Relations. You need to file a complaint for divorce. A simple motion for separate maintenance is sufficient, and the Court of Appeals can then decide to give full possession and residence to one spouse or the other.
But what do you do in the meantime?
Well,
this court order came one day too late.
And I think that is what has created the problem here and why the First District and the trial court were groping for some other solution. But the thing is, we don't need to convict Mr. O'Neill of burglary to tell him that it's wrong to kill his spouse.
But what if all the necessary elements are present to get a court order? And because of delay, the court order is not given. Why should that person have to suffer the consequences of delay because of something she didn't do?
Well, the problem is we don't know that all of the elements to get the court order were present because there was never a hearing held on it. There was no hearing ever held and no evidence ever taken on the question of whether there was an incident of domestic violence prior to this killing.
Wasn't the order granted the day after she was killed?
The order was signed the day after she was killed, I think, in an attempt by the court to avoid embarrassment. But it was not properly signed and had been appealed and filed as to the signing of that order. Because neither party appeared, no evidence was taken by the court, there was no way that an order could have properly been granted. There never was a hearing on this application. No court ever passed on whether Mr. O'Neill properly had been excluded from his residence at that time. And that actually is the motive for what followed. The killing that followed in Mr. O'Neill's statements to the police were very clear on this matter. He was very upfront to the officers after his arrest. And the entire reason for this outburst of rage that led to his wife's death is the fact that she threw not only him, but his two children out on the street. And they had no place to live. So the very solution that we're trying to apply to the problem...
Was he concerned about the children? I thought I read where he didn't even know where they were at.
And he was very concerned about his children. And in fact, that was his... The entire gist of his statement to the police as to why this happened. You know, my children have nowhere to live. She threw them out on the street. You know, I'm an adult. I can cope. I can sleep in my car. My children have nowhere to go.
But did I read or not that he didn't know where they were at afterwards? Where his children were?
I don't believe that's correct. He may not have known precisely at the moment that the police asked the question.
Well, it appeared to me that his concern with his children was not of paramount importance to him because he didn't even know where they were at.
Well, he obviously did not make great decisions here.
Well, you're saying on one hand that the reason he did this is because his children had thrown out of the house. Didn't you?
Yes.
Yet, when asked where his children were, he didn't know where they were.
That's correct.
So that's, isn't it a little contradictory?
The children here were not so young that he could not leave them without supervision. And I think that they had, at one point in time, the children who had stayed with a relative during this 2 or 3 day period in between leaving the house and his arrest. They were not with him at the time of the shooting.
Is your point here to have dismissed the burglary death penalty specification, and if that's the case, then it has to be remanded back for sentencing as an aggravated murder without a specification?
That's correct, and I think that is the real key here. Yes, we're not saying that there was not an offense. Mr. O'Neill never claimed that there was not an offense. We're not saying that it should be legal for him to kill his wife, whether he does it on the street, in a car, or in their home. What we're saying is it's not necessary create a new rule of law and bootstrap a burglary conviction onto this case to say we get the proof of killing your wife.
But you're saying, in other words, that it's legal for him to break into the house to do that.
Well, Your Honor, if he kicked down the door of the house, sat down on the couch, and said, I really need to talk to you about this, you know, we need to talk about our estrangement here, we need to see if we can work things out for the sake of the children, would any charge be filed with me? Will you have been charged with any good burglary? Will you have been convicted of it?
If he had done that, she'd be still alive.
That's correct. If he'd done that, she'd be still alive. His kicking down the door of the house had nothing to do with whether she died or not.
It's a conjecture. I said she'd still be alive. She said no one was talking to her dad.
That's right. That's right.
But you know what? She's right about the
statute. Well, the question is, it's your car, but it's not your door. If they steal your property and they're in your house, are you allowed to open the door of your house to go in and try to recover your property? If they hide your property in your own home, if they take your property and they put it in their home, are you allowed to break into their home? And if you break into their home, your neighbor, and Mr. O'Neill didn't break into someone else, if you do not have possession, you may have perhaps legal attitude, but you do not have possession of it, are you not required to
cases.
You cannot steal your own property, you cannot damage your own property colonially, and you can't convert it.
You can't convert it.
But you can commit other criminal offenses in the process of doing that, and you certainly can be prosecuted for those criminal offenses. We can't cure the problem of domestic violence by creating a new program.
If counsel, if we didn't have this, if we weren't dealing with this statute, if it were determined that the statute really doesn't apply, where would we be in a trespass in this case with involving the element of trespass for burglary
even without the statute.
I think.
You still got the same problem.
Right.
Cannot trespass on
your own. Right. And it, so I think that that's even a different argument, that despite whether or not this statute has applicability in the criminal context, the, you know, the argument is still, would it always be a case-by-case analysis by the jury about the level of privilege that a spouse would have to enter property? Say it's a spat, as somebody suggests in the brief, you know, a marital spat, and not, there's no nuances of the wife has the lease or the wife rented the property or they've been separated more than, you know, an hour and a half.
And how does the jury decide whether this is a mutual decision or not?
Right.
We don't mean to say that every little marital spat where somebody changes the locks of the court is going to become a burglary. So we're saying we're creating a rule only for cases that are high publicity, that involve domestic violence, because this is a hot button issue, but this rule shouldn't apply universally. That's not the solution. If you need to craft a specific rule for domestic violence situation, then by all means petition the legislature and let's craft a specific rule. Let's have it clearly defined by statute so that a judge knows how to instruct a jury, and let's do it right.
It's probably not a much more difficult task for a jury to assess privilege, you know, the concept of privilege, than it is intent, or, you know, I'm not sure that that's a concept too difficult to trust to the jury's assessment of the individual facts. Is it necessary to have a bright line rule?
It's necessary, I believe.
Yes.
Of the basic terms that a jury
can. But each of those terms is defined. I mean, trespass is defined and privilege is defined in the statute.
Oh, it's defined in the statute, but that's not the definition that was read to the jury. The definition that was read to the jury is the O'Neill 1 rule, which has nothing to do with the statutory definition.
Right, okay.
And that's where the problem comes. And is each judge on the trial bench going to craft its own definition since we have no statutory definition?
My question really related to whether, or it, in the event that the statute in the Title 31 were determined not to apply, which gives more of a bright line rule. I think the argument that is made on behalf of your client is that gives us more of a bright line rule. If married, you have the right to enter. But if not, you still have defined terms in the statute. I'm not.
And if the jury had been read those definitions, we wouldn't be here with this argument. We wouldn't have this problem. That's not the definition.
Right.
In fact, they were given not only the O'Neill 1 definition, but the judge threw in another paragraph that says when a husband and wife are estranged, both parties understand that they're living separate apart, a husband may not use force to enter the wife's residence. If he does so, that's trespass. Which has nothing to do with the O'Neill 1 rule. The user, failure to use force was not really an element in their decision, although there were some other cases that came out of lower courts in Ohio that suggested that the use of force might be a deciding factor. So that has thrown in there for the jury's consideration also. And in fact, the jury came back with a question, the court saying, please define for us the term estranged, because we don't know what that means. Mm. And of course, the court could not do so because there wasn't that issue. So the jury received no further instruction on that. A person's home, their residence, has always been considered safe in our law, our entire system. And for that reason, the court has been very careful about constructive remedies that involve removing the person even temporarily from possession of their residence.
Can you trespass on your spouse's separate property?
Yes. On your spouse's separate property?
Like here. Or like another situation where she moves out and rents her own place. And then he breaks in there. Can that be trespass?
Again, it's quite possible that the jury could have found that the question under the prison statute, it's a question of whether that's her residence. If she has a separate property that she's not residing in, then that prison statute wouldn't apply to it at all. If for them she had business.
No, if she's got a separate property she's residing in.
So she's residing. Then, if you apply the prison statute, no, he cannot be found to trespass in that property if she's residing. If you apply the O'Neill 1 rule, that's the situation that there may be. Yeah, it would be
the statute speaks to it cannot be excluded from the other's dwelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's specific to the dwelling of the resident of the spouse. It's not to any property owned by the spouse.
So absent force or violence, there could be no charge of trespass, burglary, anything.
That's right.
You have absolute access to your spouse's separate residence.
So long as no crime is committed, either in obtaining the access or once access has been obtained. That's the wording of the statute. But as was indicated, even if we set aside the statute and say this was never intended to apply to a criminal situation, we still come back to the traditional definition of trespass. And all of the case law up to our current concerns with domestic violence situation apply that traditional definition of trespass, which says that a husband doesn't trespass when he enters a residence of his wife. By common law, that would be a rule long before that statute.
31, I would like to hear your response to this. 3103.04, the heading of the statute is interest in the property of the other. Was on state. Neither husband nor wife has any interest in the property of the other except as mentioned in section 3103.03 of the revised code. And we go on to say the right to dower, the right to remain in the mansion house after the death of either. Neither can be excluded from the other's dwelling except upon a decree or order of injunction made by a court of competent jurisdiction. Now, it's my interpretation of this particular statute was written by the General Assembly. It's a totally different intention than what you're trying to put forth today. This was about the right of dower, the right to remain in the mansion house after one spouse died. And you're attempting to apply it in a criminal way. Explain those words, because I think that statute, as I read it, all applies to excluding a spouse after the death of another spouse. That's what I think the intention of that statute was.
Well, that's not what the clear language of the statute says, and in fact, the right to remain after the death is a separate clause.
What do you mean by the clear language?
That neither may be excluded from the dwelling of the other.
You're just taking one phrase. And having that dominate the entire wording of the statute and the purpose of the statute.
Well, that phrase is separate from the phrase concerning doubt. Now, do I think that this statute is basically concerned with possessory and property interests in marriage? Yes. But trespass is defined in terms of possessory interest in the property. Property law does have application to the law of trespass because that's how we define the trespass. The person who has a possessory interest in the property can't trespass. And as I indicated, this statute has been applied in common law situations or in criminal law situations for a number of years. I've been practicing criminal law for 20 years. I've had probably three or four situations where there was an attempt made to charge a spouse with trespass, theft, or burglary of common marital property. This rule has been applied for a long time and applied very evenly in the courts to that specific situation. If the legislature certainly has been on notice for a number of years that it's being applied in that fashion. They have not seen it to modify or to indicate that it is not intended to be applied in that situation. They certainly have had every opportunity to do so. And again, they have created an entire network of ways and means to obtain the court order necessary to exclude a spouse from common marital dwelling. All of those procedures, however, require that the person being excluded from his own home or her own home be be given some kind of hearing, some opportunity to respond, to present evidence, to defend their right to their own home. A rule proposed by Amendment 1 basically says that one spouse may unilaterally kick the other one out, change the locks, and without providing any kind of hearing in front of a court or a magistrate, by that means exclude the other person totally from his own home and prevent him from re-entering without the commission of a serious felony offense. I don't think that is what the legislature had ever intended. And if they had, they wouldn't have created this network of hearings and court orders in order to exclude someone from the felony.
Why would we not read this statute in conjunction with the criminal trespass statute that in section E talks about controlled by or in the custody of another? Because the property, while the ownership is conceded, they both owned the property or had a right to it, the criminal trespass statute goes on and doesn't just say a place belonging to, it says controlled by or in the custody of another. Clearly, this property was controlled by or in her custody, was it not?
Well, lawfully, that's the question. She changed the locks without any permission, any reference to any legal right to do so. If she unlawfully excludes him from the residence in some fashion, does that then give her lawful control of possession?
Okay, but I asked you during coverture if you could ever avoid this, and you said no. What if we don't have the facts of this case, but she moves out into her own abode, a separate place altogether, controlled by her, custody in her, belonging to her by lease or otherwise?
I think that gives you a clear-cut situation under the O'Neill 1 rule. I still don't think it gets you under the...
Would you have criminal trespass in that case, then?
I don't believe so. If you accept that the privilege statute applies to criminal situations.
But my point is, can't we read them together, or shouldn't we read them together? Because the criminal trespass statute is pretty clear with regard to that.
Well, I think that all of the case law applying the criminal trespass statute until we ran into this roadblock with the current problems with domestic violence made it pretty clear, again, that that did not apply in situations where the person who allegedly trespassed had possessory interest or right to possessory rights and property.
And your possessory right that you're talking about gives you from the privilege statute.
Well, no, not from the privilege statute. From the fact that this is Mr. O'Neill's home.
Yep. But if it were not, you see, this case is going to be used for every case where a spouse goes into, generally, his spouse's separate residence. It's going to be used in every case. We can't just say only in the case where it's the marital home. I suppose we could. But that would then leave open the question if it isn't the marital home, wouldn't it? And then you'd be back here saying, a statute doesn't have any qualifications. It says a separate abode of or residence of.
The situation here, excuse me, I think my time is up.
We have about 2 minutes remaining.
The situation here is creating a lot of problems. And that's why we're here. That's why we have courts of wrestle with this case back and forth over its entire history. Yes, it creates a very difficult problem. The solution to that problem is with the legislature. Of course, because of the very difficulties that you're addressing here. How is the court going to grab onto statutes that clearly don't contain any such provision? Some kind of rule that can be universally applied. If a rule is needed here, the legislature needs to address this and provide us with a rule that clearly puts the defendant on notice as to what behavior will subject him to a burglary conviction, and also give the court guidance as to how that determination is.
Thank you, Ms. Nager. Mr. Bob Schreier.
Your trespass into his own property. And of those earlier cases, I think the Windrush case, which I cited in the brief, which of course earlier, Halifax County Court of Appeals, is most similar to this particular case. Windrush, the court recognized that trespass protects custody and possession of property. It's not aimed towards hiring. The trespass statute nowhere mentions the word title except construed controlled by or in custody of title. But the trespass statute goes well beyond that. It protects the interest of the person who is in custody of or possession of or control of a particular piece of property. In the Windrush case, which anteceded this case by quite a bit of time, held that the husband could be convicted of trespass from Windrush and that while recognizing that very thing. I don't think this is really a new situation. It's entirely unanticipated. I think it's a first time we can't apply such an unfortunate set of facts. In this case, the first arose back in 1993, 94, and went to the trial court. The trial court threw out all the aggravated freeway charges. Of course, the prosecution appealed that to the Court of Appeals. The prosecution's position is really not the position that was accepted by the Court of Appeals in Appeal 1. We relied on just a straight reading of the trespass statute to argue to the court that whoever was in custody, control, or possession of the property, it was there. They were the ones that were protected by the trespass statute and the aggravated burglary statute. The Court of Appeals did not totally accept our position. They said that through custody, control, or possession, we get to demonstrate that the other party realized he no longer lived. They added a little bit to that definition.
Is there any significant discussion in the three cases you cite to us, Heron, Windrush, and the other one, Harder or Herder? Any significant discussion in those cases about the statute with which we deal today?
Are you referring to the civil statute, Judge? They do not mention that statute, but in the Windrush case, I think it's very telling that they hang their hat on. They say the husband cannot enforce his possessory rights through violence.
Yeah, I know what they say, but then they then they ignore the statute.
Right, but I think that's a direct reference to the statute. I'm too close to make in regard to that. The position that Justice Resnick outlined, her interpretation of that statute, that's the position that the Court of Appeals took in oral arguments. They read that statute as not getting any application in the criminal context. It was directed towards other interests designed to protect other interests. In the decision, then you know, one may have to read a privy sentence that statute doesn't apply. It's designed to protect other interests. And just, that's what they would discuss in oral arguments. That was the position they took with regard to that statute. Secondly, I think the law everywhere, not only Ohio, but everywhere, always protects life at the expense of property. We're going to relegate property interests to protect life interests. And I was thinking last night, what's a prior decision of this court, which was close, which may have kind of anticipated this. The case that comes to mind is the State versus Tembauer case. I don't know if you want to remember that. I think it's reported in the Royal Ohio State Firm. In the syllabus paragraph for us this evening, the point of that case was, you cannot use force to resist an unlawful arrest. You can't do that. You have to submit to it. And I think that kind of anticipates what the Court of Appeals is saying here and what the Windrush Court said, that he has that sentence there. The husband cannot enforce his rights by violence. That even if that statute, so my point would be, even if that statute gets some minimal application, I don't believe it does, you still would have no right to enforce your statutory interest through the use of violence. You may have to go to court to enforce those particular interests.
The facts were a little bit different. The door was unlocked or standing open in the summer, and he simply walked in and had a fire. Would you have some charges for him?
That would be a much closer case. The aggravated burglary statute says by door, stealth, or deception, enter an occupied structure. And Calvin doesn't say of another, it says enter an occupied structure.
And he,
say he did that. Say he walked in and did that. It would be a closed case. I recall the death case, another death penalty case out of the store where the defendant was a door-to-door salesman who was invited into the home by the defendant and then by the chief of the victim and then killed the victim. And he was convicted of aggravated burglary.
If he had said that, let me in, I want to talk to you, I want to work things out, and but he came intending to kill her and use that, then that qualified as exception?
Yes, I'll do that in an amplified exception. Remember, the aggravated burglary statute requires not only that you gain access, but that you gain access to the purpose of a crime there. So, yes, I think that would be used as a deceptive measure to gain access. Yes.
Just let us raise the question of what is legal custody or what is lawful to school sales and lawful to school. If this had been a different fact pattern where the spouse was simply greedy and wanted to out herself and the other spouse had done nothing wrong and it changed all the law and changed everything, would that person be privileged to use force to go back and gain her possessions? Or would they be required to go to court to gain her possession, even though they absolutely own the house and own the contents and it's absolutely there?
I think they would be required to go to court to gain a civil order on the property. It's a difficult fact matter. I'd like to point the court to a distinction in this particular case. It kind of helps us avoid that big issue. There was a lease, and there was rental property, there was a lease, but the only tenant on the lease is the debtors. The debtor was not present on that lease, and she was the one that had the right to control the property. I think the closer you get, the fact that you need to try.
Yeah, we can't base this case and all the other cases on a a technicality like that. Nobody would, we'd be deciding every one of them on their facts, wouldn't we? Who was,
no,
who
just...
Quick
answer to that question. If you had taken a meal one out of the blue, then you'd allow to get the meal 100%. But I know that the court is going to force the case because it's a death penalty case and it comes here. But it comes here for your consideration by law. So I think you could, in all fairness, you could apply it to this particular case. Really haven't taken this case in to write a rule of law. It is here because you can't. So I think in this case you could rely on that. I don't want you to.
Well, maybe we didn't take O'Neill 1 in because we agreed with it or disagreed with it. It just might have been one of 120 that week.
Sure, I understand that. And I want the court to write a general rule here. But I'm just pointing out for my own case. That is
your bottom line in this whole thing is this statute, why are we even talking about it? It doesn't even apply.
I believe that would be correct. I believe that's what the court rules out here.
And your best argument for that is the following language in the statute?
The best argument for that is that the aggravated burglary statute prohibits a person from forcibly entering, forcibly trespassing in an occupied structure. Trespass is defined by statute. It protects occupancy and possession. It doesn't protect private.
And
actually, the court of appeals requires to prove that you realize he no longer lived there, and as counsel for the defendant told you just a moment ago, he realized he didn't do it, and that's why he killed him. So, our burden of proof, I think, there's no question we met that burden of proof. The defendant is seated here today, and I don't think he's seriously disputed. Upon arrest, he told the police he no longer lived there.
Was it due to the the trial court's belief that the statute from Title 31 applied, that the court, the instructions from the court included these non-defined elements about estrangement and those sorts of things?
No. The original decision came back to the court of appeals. I think basically the following language from the court of appeals.
Yes. Thank you.
In essence, our position is that by contracting the burglary statute through the trespass statute, there's really not a problem here that everything fits in. And
learned colleague did not discuss this, but I was concerned about your response to the proposition of law number 3 with regard to the Batson issues. The use of the peremptories to excuse the 3 African-American, here they have Afro-American, I think they mean African-American jurors, without articulating a reason.
I think the case law in Batson comes that the initial burden is on the defendants and the showing there has been some kind of discrimination. Generally, the courts around the state have pretty much said if the prosecution would strike a minority, that's the right way to show. Most courts are requiring us just upon that to advance a race neutral explanation. The second call is the state provide a race neutral explanation through their actions. Then the trial court is required to make a decision to accept or reject that. Once the trial court accepts the race neutral explanation that's been advanced, the decisions of this court and the attorney has and the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, unless that is just clearly a ruling they have abuse of discretion, that's going to be accepted. Now, in this case, there were 3 jurors that were excused. For example, so
that's correct.
They're excused because they were questioned about the death penalty. They expressed serious reservations about it. Although they said they could do it, we have real problems. In the Wilson case, this court and the U.S. Supreme Court has also held that reservations found for the death penalty are a proper basis for a primary challenge, even if the person you're excusing is a minority. That was clearly the case with the first 2 jurors. The third juror,
she's the one that bothers me a lot.
But in Greek before dear, she was basically a social worker type who felt that the Simpson verdict had been correct. And she go on, and those are the public reasons that the prosecution used, and I think that's out. But she also indicated she made a hard time deliberating with other jurors.
So we have a social worker type exemption, huh? Or disqualification.
Social worker type.
Yeah.
Social worker type would be discharged. Those prosecutors do not like to get a very liberal
people on their jury. Is that right?
Mm.
That comes as a real surprise. I would never want to be on your jury.
But that was the reason for advance. They were accepted by the trial court, and they're valid racial reasons. The jury that heard the case didn't contain 2 black members. One of the blacks who was excused was replaced by another black juror. But I personally don't think the first call was shown. I don't think there was a shown that a incriminating case of racial abuse demonstrated.
That's your response. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Breyer. Ms. Agar, you saved 1 minute of your time.
Would I ever be on your jury?
You could be on my jury.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I don't understand why Mr. Breyer's fighting all these liberal jurors and don't tell you to worry about. Not on my panel, apparently. Judge, Mr. Breyer, this court has always been more interested in preserving the rights of life and personal safety of other rights of property. And I would be having a quarrel with that. A statute here, even a statute that clearly made a burglary offense for the term to go into his wife's residence would not have prevented the tragedy of rehab. A restraining order would probably not have prevented the tragedy of rehab. We cannot in all cases deter violence, particularly in a highly charged emotional area of relations between spouses. It's not necessary to strain at creating another offense here that really does not fit within the law to try and achieve the goals of preserving spousal rights. We have a number of laws to attempt to do that. We can enforce them better. But threatening someone with a burglary conviction when you're already facing the possibility of a murder conviction and death penalty is not going to deter it.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.